The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by the 9th of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. The Housing Secretary, Robert Jenrick, was the government's chief spokesman today as England edges ever closer towards the planned relaxation of COVID restrictions on July the 19th. Jenrick told Trevor Phillips that the government was still cautiously optimistic.
I think we are now reaching a different phase in the virus. We're not going to put the COVID-19 virus behind us forever. We're going to have to learn to live with it. But thanks to the enormous success of our vaccine programme, the fact that now we've got to the point where 83% of adults in this country have had at least one jab, we should be able to think about how we can return to normality as much as possible. And the data that we're seeing, that the Prime Minister's reviewing at the moment ahead of his decision point on the roadmap, looks very positive. It does seem as if we can now move forward and move to a much more permissive regime where we move away from many of those restrictions that have been so difficult for us. And as you say, learn to live with the virus. That does mean that we're going to have to treat it carefully. We're going to have to keep on monitoring the cases. And we're going to have to ensure that every adult gets double vaxxed, because that is the key to keeping the virus under control as we move into the autumn and the winter.
That's admirably clear, and it looks as though you are following the Prime Minister's suggestion that we will be lifting the restrictions. But the BMA, the British Medical Association, is urging caution, for example, keeping the requirement for face masks in public places. Now, if you are permitted, will you be getting rid of your mask?
I will. I don't particularly want to wear a mask. I don't think a lot of people enjoy doing it. We will be moving into a phase, though, where these will be matters of personal choice. And so some members of society will want to do so for perfectly legitimate reasons. But it will be a different period where we as private citizens make these judgments rather than the government telling you what to do.
Andrew Marr also spoke to Jenrick and asked him about the progress that was being made on removing dangerous cladding from high-rise buildings.
4 years after Grenfell, the government identified 469 buildings in England with that same dangerous cladding. How many of those have had it removed?
Well, 95% of those buildings have either had the cladding removed or there are workers on site now removing it, and about 70% of them have finished the job altogether. Completions are happening literally every week, and we expect that all bar a very small number of exceptional cases, that work to be finished by the end of the year.
So 95%, if I may say so, isn't really a meaningful figure, because that can simply mean somebody sticking up a sign or arriving on site. Now, the last figures that we've got...
I said that 70% of the buildings have been finished, and the rest will be finished, barring very exceptional circumstances, by the end of this year.
So you say 70%. We've got the latest figures from the Building Safety Programme. That's the monthly data release for the 31st of May, not long ago. And then only 260 out of the 469 had been completed. The starting work had started on 173 and had not started, nothing had happened on 33, which would suggest that 55% of the buildings with this aluminium composite cladding had not yet had it removed.
No, but work is happening very fast now. So it takes time to get workers on site, but once they are, work happens quite quickly. And so we expect the work to be finished by the end of this year. So every week you'll be seeing buildings completed, and I follow this data very closely, and so, you know, I could tell you the buildings that next week we expect to be completed.
Jenrick also highlighted a change that the government would be making aimed at helping affected homeowners take more control of their situation.
It is not right that either the leaseholder or the taxpayer has to step up, and I'm announcing today that we're going to change the law retrospectively to give every homeowner 15 years in which to take action against the people who built their building if there's shoddy workmanship. I wish we hadn't reached this point. More developers had paid up.
Well, let me ask you about that. So people who are in buildings which are unsafe but are 20 years old get no help at all.
Well, this is a huge step forward. The law as we found it was that you only had 6 years as a homeowner to take action against the person who built your home. That often gives you less protection than if you bought a toaster or a fridge in the shop.
Lots of the most dangerous buildings are more than 15 years old.
Not many are, actually. Most of the cladded buildings that we're talking about here were built in the period from 2000 to 2017 when we had the Grenfell tragedy. So not all, I appreciate, but many, the lion's share of the buildings that are facing this particular issue will now be helped by this quite unusual change in the law.
So two questions. One, why should those people not be treated fairly? But also, two, all this does is it allows groups of leaseholders, tenants, to get together and take a legal case against a very, very powerful, well-funded, well-lawyered development company. Now, that is not a level playing field. It can take years and years and years for these legal cases to come, and it's going to be very, very expensive for them. So it sounds much, much better than it is.
Well, I don't think there's any easy way out of this situation. You're absolutely right. I want the developers, the builders, the warranty companies, the insurers, to pay up. I want shoddy workmanship to be paid for by the people who did it, not by the leaseholders. That is happening in some cases. About 50% of the cost of removing the Grenfell-style cladding has been paid for by the people who put it up. We're also seeing more of the larger developers coming forward. Since I made an announcement in February asking them to do so, they've committed £500 million to do that. That's your big volume house builders. This new change in the law, I think, does put new cards in the hands of the leaseholders so they can take action.
Marr also spoke to the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. While discussing the cost of social care, he pressed Reeves to be candid about how Labour would finance any changes they intended to make on the issue.
Are you brave enough to say that taxes may have to rise to protect our oldest citizens?
I said that at the beginning, my answer to your question.
Yes,
we are willing to look at how you fund it, because as Shadow Chancellor...
Willing to look at how you fund it is not quite saying yes, taxes may have to rise.
Yes, including looking at what taxes may need to pay for it, as Andy Burnham did when he was Health Secretary, which is why the Tories walked out of it. And I just want to be clear about this, because as Shadow Chancellor, and I hope in the future as Chancellor, I will make sure that any policies that I set out and that Labour set out will be fully costed, and we explain how they will be paid for. That is really important to me, because value for money and using taxpayers' money well really matters to me.
Phillips asked Reeves about Labour's performance in the Batley and Spen by-election, which the party held with a majority of just 323 votes.
Well, it was a great result in Batley and Spen, and I can't tell you how pleased I am that Kim Leadbeater is going to be joining me in Parliament on Monday, tomorrow, as the Member of Parliament for Batley and Spen. And it's a seat that means so much to all of us in the Labour Party. And Kim is an inspiration. She will shake up Westminster in every good possible way. And that by-election, which I fought hard in as well, it's very near to me in Leeds West, was a by-election like none other that I have seen during my 25 years involved in the Labour Party and in politics. It was a campaign full of so much hatred and division, stoked by people from outside of Batley and Spen. And that victory in the early hours of Friday morning was a victory for decency over division, for hope over hatred, and for integrity in politics. And that is the Labour Party that Keir Starmer stands for. And it is the Labour Party that is embodied by the campaign that Kim and the team ran in Batley and Spen. So I am delighted by the result and can't wait to see Kim get started as MP in Westminster and in her community.
Reeves did not beat about the bush when asked who was responsible for the unpleasant nature of the campaign.
You spoke of the hatred and division being sowed in that election campaign, as did Sir Keir on Friday morning. Who exactly was sowing hatred and division?
Well, I mean, I was there on many occasions, and I saw some of the behaviours of George Galloway and his campaign, and the violence and aggression shown towards both Kim and other Labour activists. There is no place for the sort of behaviour that we saw in Batley and Spen in any election, but especially in a place like Batley and Spen that has been through so much in the last 5 years or so and deserved so much better than what they saw during this by-election campaign. And the people of Batley and Spen rejected that, and they voted for Kim. And Kim is now their MP, and I know that Kim will do everything in her power to bring the community together, as she has over the last 5 years, running schemes like More in Common, Batley and Spen. And I am so proud of Kim, but also of the people of Batley and Spen.
And finally, on Sky, the DUP's new leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, reiterated his party's call for reform of the Northern Ireland Protocol, the effects of which have seen considerable unrest on the streets.
It is imperative for all of us that we resolve these issues. I'm not accepting that this can't be done. I'm not accepting that there is no solution. I believe there is, and that's what I'm going to strive for, and I'm not going to contemplate failure.
You talk about the tension on the streets. The DUP says the government is aware and is listening to the concerns, but this is the same government that promised your party there would never be an Irish sea border. So why should the loyalists who are protesting trust this government?
Well, I understand their scepticism. I really do. We've heard the Prime Minister, even in recent weeks, talk about addressing the issues and the problems created by the protocol. We've heard him recognise that there are difficulties in terms of the relationship between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, but not just in trading terms. The Prime Minister also needs to recognise that this impacts on our constitutional position. I'm prepared always to give people a second chance, and I'm prepared to give the Prime Minister an opportunity now to put right what was done wrong to Northern Ireland under the protocol.
But there are those who would say it's time for the DUP to put right the wrong of promoting a Brexit that was going to require a border somewhere. Is it perhaps time to look at the positive, to promote the benefits of having access to the EU market and the GB market?
I believe there are opportunities going forward, but we can't get to those opportunities because of these unnecessary barriers. Much of our supply chain comes from Great Britain. Whether you are a consumer buying goods in a supermarket or a business relying on component parts for your manufacturing process, we need to fix that supply chain problem. We need to restore Northern Ireland's place within the UK, both the market and constitutionally. And if we can do that, then yes, we will see the opportunities that will flow, provided we can find practical solutions on trade with the EU.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffee House Shots podcast on the iTunes store. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe to our daily Evening Blend email. It's a free roundup of all the political news each day, along with analysis and a diary on what to expect next. Just go to spectator.co.uk/eveningblend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.